From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. This is Idaho Matters. We've heard many stories of what happened after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, when more than 100,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and sent to what were known then as relocation centers, including the Minidanka camp in eastern Idaho. But one story that you may not have heard is how many of the men sent to Minidoka were later drafted to serve in World War II, and how many of them resisted the draft, refusing to fight for the country that put them and their families behind barbed wire. And that's the story behind a stage play, Traveling the State. It was written and performed by Idaho lawyers 80 years after the anniversary of those cases going to trial. And it's also being told in a new documentary on Idaho Public Television. So joining us today are Bill Manny, executive producer with Idaho Public Television, Jeff Thompson, the writer, director, and actor in The Nisi Paradox, and Robin Achilles, executive director of the Friends of Minidoka. I want to welcome all of you to the program today.
Hi, Gemma.
Good afternoon.
So, hello, Gemma. Hi, everyone. So, Jeff, can I begin with you? Let's start with the play. How did it come about, and how did you get involved with this?
Well, at the time that I began the project, I was an attorney, and I received a call from a federal judge, Ron Bush, who asked me to visit him in his chambers. At the time, I recall being a little bit worried about coming to visit a federal judge in his chambers. I didn't have any cases in front of him at the time, but nevertheless, when a federal judge calls you and asks you to visit him, that's cause for some amount of anxiety. But as it turned out, he had heard that I was involved with theater, and he had stumbled upon this chapter of Idaho history regarding the Japanese-American young men who had resisted the draft and were tried here in Boise 80 years ago. Before then, Judge Chase A. Clark, our former governor, and he was wondering whether there was some method by which we could tell this story to the legal community, and specifically at the Bench and Bar Conference for the federal bar, asked if I would be interested in trying to brainstorm with him to come up with some way to present this story. I said to Judge Bush, yes, I'm interested. And he then supplied me with a tremendous amount of research that he had done. I reviewed that research, tried to think of a method by which we could tell the story that would be transportable, because the Bench and Bar Conference were going to be in Coeur d'Alene and in Boise. And the hope was that we could take it to other places. And so I wrote this staged reading multimedia play.
And Jeff, so my understanding, the basic plot of this play is there were these Japanese American men and their families. They were interned in Minidoka, and then they get drafted to fight for America, and they refuse.
That's correct. And it goes back a little further than that, because initially, and so Japanese American Nisei are those that are born in the United States, mm-hmm. and therefore American citizens. So those people of Japanese descent that were born here were citizens of the United States. But nevertheless, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, they were initially classified as enemy aliens. And that meant they were disqualified or unqualified to serve their country. Mm-hmm. The War Department felt that they needed more bodies to fight the war, and so they opened up to volunteers from the Japanese Americans, the Nisei. Minidoka was actually the camp that had the greatest percentage of volunteers of all the camps when they did open it up to volunteering. And then they changed the classification from enemy alien to 1A, which meant that they were qualified and able to or required to sign up for the draft. And then these individuals, some of them, felt that they were conflicted by this requirement of a country to fight for the rights of the individuals in that country when their rights had been taken away and they were in these concentration camps.
And Jeff, my understanding is you had actual court documents, correct, that you could pull from?
We did. We had the trial court docket sheets that had some information on them. We were able to go to Seattle and do some research of the archives there, which had additional documents, including the loyalty oaths that were signed by these individuals, the draft notices that were sent by these individuals or sent to these individuals, and other documents.
And Bill, how did you get involved and then decide to make a documentary about this story?
So, you know, Idaho Experience, our history documentary series, started in 2018. And we first started talking with Judge Bush and Jeff Thompson about that time. And timing wasn't right when we first talked to them. And it was sort of on the back burner. And a couple of years ago, we decided it was something we wanted to try to tackle. And then as we started working on the project, we realized that the Friends of Minidoka was also going to use 2024 as a time to remember these trials. And so we started working on this documentary, and just really through happenstance, the timing worked out so that we could present our documentary when the Friends of Minidoka were also asking Jeff and his cast to restage these plays this year.
And Robin, what about you? How did you find out about all of this?
Well, you know, we friends at Friends of Minidoka and Minidoka National Historic Site, you know, the Japanese American community has been commemorating these 80th anniversaries since 2022, which was the signing of Executive Order 9066, which basically paved the way for incarceration. And because Japanese Americans were incarcerated for 3.5 years, we're seeing all of these 80th anniversaries come up. And, you know, the trials of the Minidoka draft resistors was really important to us because it's a lesser known story. And there's a lot of bravery that these men had to have in order to resist the draft. And, you know, they suffered a great deal because of it. And so we wanted to bring to light their story.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, I want to take a bit of a deeper dive into the play itself, because you do focus in the play on one case in particular. So can you give us a little sketch of the man who you follow in the play?
Well, when I saw all of those legal documents, I realized that no single trial was exactly the same, that the defense put up by these prominent attorneys who were appointed by Judge Clark varied from non-participation by these attorneys because of their own innate prejudice to a scorched earth attempt to find their client innocent of resisting the draft based on various constitutional arguments. And as a consequence, I couldn't really focus on a single actual person. So the literary conceit that I came up with was to create a composite defendant and a composite defense attorney, composite prosecutor, composite FBI agent, that brought all of these factors together within themselves and created a composite trial to try and represent all of these different viewpoints and all of these different arguments, and as well as the state's argument that, hey, you didn't sign up for the, or you didn't you refuse to go to the draft, and that's illegal. And there's really no excuse for not doing so. So the trick was to try and even the playing field in such a manner that at least there was some hope that these individuals would be found not guilty.
Jeff, you know, one thing that I appreciated was that when you started the playoff, you started with some history, including how many Americans felt at that time about people with Jewish, Japanese ancestry living among them. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you set that up?
The research that had been provided to me by Judge Bush included newspaper articles from various newspapers around the state who reported on the events that were going on at that time, reported on the prejudices of the individuals involved in government, private individuals, and including the individual who became the judge on these trials, and that was former Governor Chase Clark, who had made it very clear that he did not appreciate the federal government trying to bring these people to Idaho, and made it very clear that if they were brought to Idaho, they could not buy property, they must leave at the end of the war, and while they were here, they must be put in his words, concentration camps.
Robin, what Jeff just described, I would make the assumption that that was fairly accurate as to the sentiment of the time.
Absolutely. Right. The incarceration of Japanese Americans started, you know, far before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, there were laws that banned Japanese immigrants from becoming citizens. There were laws that prevented people from purchasing land. So there's this long history of discrimination against the Japanese American community, which kind of spurred this unjust incarceration. So yes, you are absolutely correct.
And Robin, what do we know about how those folks who were incarcerated in Minidoka felt about the war, but also how they were treated by their fellow Americans?
Yeah, it was difficult. You hear, the first thing is our families did not speak of this after the war because it was too painful for them. So we often didn't even understand what camp meant. You know, after the 1980s kind of reparations and redress movement, the stories started coming out. And so we do have oral histories. We also have journals about what it was like for Japanese Americans when they left their homes, and then what it was like at Minidoka when they actually had to go work outside of the camp. And then also what it was like when they resettled after they left camp. And the sentiment, the anti-Asian sentiment was really hard for them, even after leaving Minidoka. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, there is a scene in the documentary that I watched that Idaho Public Television produced where they say, well, you've arrested other people besides, you know, these Japanese Americans who are refusing to fight. And the lawyer says, well, yes, we've arrested Jehovah's Witness. And they said, you know, because it doesn't matter if you've been drafted, you know, you need to fight. And then they're asked on cross-examination, well, but are these folks, you know, incarcerated? And the answer was, well, no, of course not. And, you know, isn't that the crux of it right there? Is you have literally jailed people, and now you are requiring that they fight for the country that is literally jailing them based solely on their race.
Exactly. It is, you know, I find it baffling that there weren't more Japanese Americans who said that this was unfair and that they shouldn't be required to fight for a country who had taken away all of their civil liberties, taken away their property, forced them to relocate to places like the sagebrush desert of Southeast Idaho without recompense, without due process. There was never a trial, never a hearing, never any process to determine whether, in fact, any of these individuals were actually disloyal or disloyal enough to be incarcerated. We have to remember that two-thirds of the people that were relocated were women and children. The argument is basically, you have stripped these individuals of their citizenship. The draft only applies to citizens. So how can you find that these individuals who have refused to be drafted have violated the law, because it only applies to citizens and you have not treated these individuals as citizens?
So, Bill, how did you and Idaho Public Television go about telling this story in documentary form?
Well, so it's a unique documentary challenge, right? You had the story of Minidoka itself, what happened, why all these folks were at a camp, at a prison camp in the middle of Idaho. And you have the story of these young men who decided not to accept the draft and to go to court and go to jail ultimately to stick up for their principles. And then you have the story of these modern judges and lawyers who decided that this story needed to be told. And so we have three different stories we're telling. And so in order to do that, Jeff and his cast came to the studio at Idaho Public Television in February, and we filmed them doing the play. So we filmed a night of rehearsal, and we stopped them and started them and did close-ups and all the things you do with cameras. And then we had a second night with an actual audience where they performed the play in full, and we recorded it. And so the documentary that you will see this Thursday and this Sunday blends both interviews, history, tours of Minidoka with scenes of the play that illustrate the points, this interesting notion of loyalty, right? Mm-hmm. That is at the heart of this discussion we've just had. You know, I might point out, Gemma, too, that, yeah, you know, 10,000 people at Minidoka at any one time, 13,000 in total, more than 1,000 men ended up serving in the military, 300 of them volunteered, 700 of them accepted the draft. Only 30 or 40 of them decided to resist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that notion of what it took to be loyal was such a challenging question for these families. Many, many, many people went to war. 70 some of them died. Thousands served. Only 38 or 44 resisted.
You know, Robin, I think Bill brings up such a good point that only 30 to 40 of them resisted. And yeah, that might seem baffling to us 80 years later, right? Well, why didn't more stand up? But I would think that when you look at the history of you know, the Japanese Americans who were interned at this camp, that had to take so much courage. I can't even fathom to be able to stand up and say, I will not do this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people, you know, the fact that obviously Japanese Americans had no political power, because otherwise they would not have ended up mm-hmm. in the concentration camps. And there was such wartime hysteria, racial discrimination. You know, the people who were there felt they needed to prove their loyalty by serving in the military. Others felt they needed to become, you know, prove their loyalty through that way. And there was disagreement within the Japanese American community because people didn't see those who resisted the draft as showing their loyalty to the United States. Mm-hmm. Although, in fact, you know, courage comes in many forms, and to stand up against injustice is incredibly difficult. And so these men who not only were shunned by the larger American community, they were then shunned by members of their own Japanese American community because of their civil disobedience. And so it was incredibly difficult for these men and their families. And many of these divisions within the Japanese American community linger today. And as you can imagine, I understand why. You know, if you have three sons in your family who went off to war and many of them killed, I can understand why families would feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what did you learn as you were producing this piece? Because this is such an unknown story for so many of us.
That's an interesting question. You know, you were asking earlier just about the anti-Japanese sentiment that existed in, mm-hmm. in the States in the 1930s and 40s. And Robin talked about, obviously, it predates that. But, you know, we think about that, you know, in the abstract. But when you go back and you look at these newspaper articles, you know, where you know, Japs was a common phrase in all these newspaper articles, and you see these posters and the hysterics, and you realize, you know, this was not very long ago in our past when we treated an entire group of people as dangers and aliens and other. And it's striking that in, you know, the lifetime of my parents and the lifetime of folks who are still with us, we interviewed a couple of people whose families, we interviewed one woman who went to the camp as a child. You know, in our lifetimes, we did this to a group of people, and to see it, you know, in the newspaper headlines, to go out to Minidoka, you know, to walk those trails, to see those barracks, it's a real remarkable thing that this happened in relatively modern history.
With that said, Jeff, what does the play say about our judicial system 80 years ago and how it responded to these cases?
You know, I've asked myself, if I were in the position of these defense counsel, and I have to say that at that time, defendants were not entitled to appointed counsel. Mm-hmm. That came later under Gideon versus Wainwright, where you were entitled as a criminal to somebody that's been accused of a crime to have an attorney. That didn't exist at this time. So the judge, Judge Chase Clark, went above and beyond in gathering all of these prominent Boise attorneys and saying, gentlemen, this is going to be your service to the war. I need you to defend these defendants. I've got 2 weeks to try all 33 of these cases. And you will defend them. And so, as I said, some of them did a remarkable job of trying to defend these individuals. And others, not so much. And I just always wonder, what would I have done in that situation? I would hope to have been one of those that went above and beyond and tried to get my client acquitted. But, you know, at the time, there was a mindset that existed, and it permeated the legal profession as much as it permeated the general population. Mm-hmm. What it says about our judicial system, though, is, bottom line, they broke the law. And that was the hardest thing for me to try and balance in terms of, okay, they clearly broke the law. What kind of arguments can we come up with that would potentially get them acquitted before a jury? So I think the legal system at that point and what it was faced with probably came to the conclusion that it had to come to. But I would have hoped that there would have been a breakthrough case that defied all the odds, found the person innocent, went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court then would have said, you're right, they shouldn't have to fight for a country that has treated them in this manner, And so you didn't violate the law.
Mm.
But as we know, the Supreme Court was not in favor of those sorts of decisions at that time either.
Robin, why is this play, as well as this documentary, still so important 80 years later?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We think about our society today when there's such polarization. You know, the one thing we hope to achieve with the programming we have is to help engage people in the story about the draft resistors as a way to hear, you know, different perspectives and acknowledge that people make choices based on their beliefs and values. And we need to make space for this spectrum of beliefs and choices and respect people for making those choices. You know, the narrative for the Japanese American community has been about those who served in the military, which no doubt is incredibly brave and courageous, but these draft resistors were also incredibly courageous through their civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make sure we acknowledge that people make different decisions and different choices. And all are because they want to make sure our nation lives up to the ideals that upon which it was founded.
Bill, before I let all of you go, when can people see the documentary on Idaho Public Television? I know you mentioned it before, but in case folks want to hear that again.
It airs this Thursday night at 8:30 and replays again Sunday at 7:30. And if you go to, and it will stream on Idaho, idahoptv.org beginning next week. You can also go to that same website and find the full play that we recorded in February. So if you missed the presentations that the Friends of Minidoka are bringing around the state later this month, you can watch it on our website.
Well, I want to thank all of you so much. It's an incredibly powerful story. So glad we could help get the word out as well. We've been speaking with Bill Manny, executive producer with Idaho Public Television, Jeff Thompson, the writer, director, as well as actor of The Nisi Paradox, and Robin Achilles. She is the executive director of the Friends of Minidoka. We've been talking about the story of incarcerated Japanese Americans who resisted the draft in World War II. We will, of course, put links to when and where you can see the play and the documentary on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.